Okay, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Beth Ferris. I'm a senior fellow here at Brookings and co-director of the Brookings Barron Project on Internal Displacement. I'd like to welcome you to this afternoon's session on the deepening humanitarian crisis in Sri Lanka. This is a crisis that indeed has deepened even since the announcement of the event was posted, with news this morning of a fresh government offensive, with thousands of civilians leaving the so-called safe zone, and certainly the humanitarian tragedy that continues to unfold in that part of the country. But it's also important to remember that this conflict has gone on since 1983. It has been a protracted conflict that's displaced hundreds of thousands of people in differing layers of displacement with different complexities when it comes to resolving the situation. It's also a very dangerous place for humanitarian workers. According to the Internal Displacement Monitoring Center, over 70 aid workers have disappeared or been killed since 2006. We have a panel today with four individuals who will be sharing their impressions and insights from working on the issue of Sri Lanka from different capacities, and we welcome all of them. We've asked them each to speak for 10 or 15 minutes, and then we'll have time for questions and discussion at the end. We'll begin with Amina Wad here on my immediate left, who's the representative of UNHCR in Sri Lanka. You have their biographical information with you, so I won't go through it all, except to note that he has worked with UNHCR for 20 years, been in Sri Lanka for 3.5 years, and has also served in countries such as Pakistan, Yemen, Tajikistan, Macedonia, northern Iraq, and other crises around the world. He'll then be followed by Mike Owen, who's Acting Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for South and Central Asian Affairs. Prior to this, he was director of the State Department's Office for India, Nepal, Sri Lanka, the Maldives, and Bhutan. And before that, he served in Mumbai, also in Tanzania, Ghana, Colombo, Karachi, and other places. Our third speaker will be Muthukrishna Savanarayanan, who is a development economist and principal researcher at the Point Pedro Institute of Development in northern Sri Lanka. He's currently a Fulbright visiting scholar at the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University. He's done a lot of field research in Sri Lanka and has written several books both on the economy and on the crisis situation. Finally, we'll hear from Anna Neistat, who's a senior researcher at Human Rights Watch and a specialist in humanitarian crises. She too has worked on it in a variety of situations, including Chechnya, Haiti, Zimbabwe, Nepal, and Israel. So lots of different kinds of background for our panelists, and we're delighted to have you here, and I give the floor now to Amina Wad. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and I'm happy to be here. Good afternoon. My name is Amina Wad, and I have been as the UNHCR representative in Sri Lanka since November 2005. The conflict started in 2006, and since then, as you know, following the peace agreement, events evolved, and we had the conflict continuing during the last 3.5 years, and this is the last stage of it where we are now. As far as UNHCR goes in Sri Lanka, I'll just give you a brief introductory remark perhaps about our presence and work there. We have about 150 to 160 staff members, one-third of that, about 50, are international staff. We have presence in 8 locations in the north and the east. We have presence in Jaffna, in Trincomalee, Barikalua, Ampara, Vavunia, and we had until recently a presence in Kilinochi. We still maintain a presence in Manar and in Butlam, of course, as well as in Colombo. UNHCR established presence in Sri Lanka back in the 80s, basically to deal with the return from India. And since then, our mandate evolved, the request of the government, the Secretary General to get involved with the IDBs, and we have been at it since that time. The current situation, as it stands, as the war evolved from the first spark in Trincomalee, then it went to Jaffna, back to Trincomalee, down to Barikalua, then to Manar, then through Kilinochi to Malativu, and now this is where the front line is, in that strip of land in the eastern part of Malativu. we have about anywhere from 75,000 to 180,000 or more, depending on the sources. The UN did not have presence in the Vani since September. According to the government, there are 75,000 people. According to the UN and ICRC, anywhere between 150,000 to 180,000. According to some NGOs or local groups in the Vani, the number could be as high as 3,000. Our advocacy effort at this point concentrate actually more on the people who are trapped in the Vani. Given the conflict that's going on and the exposure of the population, it's truly a population. It's civilians' population in a conflict zone. And all measures to protect them apply in this conflict in particular. UNHCR, along with other partners and many of the international actors, have been advocating hard with both sides to make sure that the civilians should be spared the ramification of the conflict. We have been asking for the LTTE to release the people, at least to allow them to move to areas where they feel safe. We've been asking the government also to not use force when there is no need, and make sure that to handle the situation with extreme caution, given the fact that now the population is very much mixed with combatants, and that it's a very small area, and people are condensed in a small part of the of that Malativu strip, and casualties are inevitable. So far, we have about 70,000 people who left the Vani into Vabunia in the north, Jaffna, and Manar. We're facing some challenges as far as receiving these people. Part of it is space, overcrowding in the 20 transit centers and camps that are available. People are coming at a higher rate now, especially during the last 3 weeks, an average of 2,000 a day. And we would like to see concerted efforts to make sure that overcrowding conditions in the transit centers, especially the schools around Vabunia, are relieved, so that people are moving to better camps. We also been advocating with the government to provide more land, so that we, UNHCR and other agencies, can help the government with the construction of camps that are meeting the minimum standard. There are challenges, and we're helping the government to address those challenges as far as the protection of IDBs are concerned in the camps. There are constraints. We understand the security concern of the government, but we are also asking the government to balance these security concerns with issues like civil liberties, freedom of movement of IDBs from these camps, the civilian characteristic of the camps. In other words, removing the military from inside the camps, replacing them with the police, with the civil administration, and keeping the military in the periphery of the camps for security reasons, obviously. We're also asking for the right of IDBs to have visitation from outside by relatives and friends. We're asking for unification of families who are separated because they exited the Vani through different routes. And we're also asking for special people in need, elderly, pregnant women, handicapped, and so on and so forth, to be also allowed to leave at once. That doesn't mean these measures should be in lieu of a freedom of movement. We still continue to advocate for freedom of movement, and we keep asking the government to grant freedom of movement to almost everybody in the camps, and they should undertake screening measures in a very speedy manner, instruction manner, and transparent manners. And if there's a need to separate the combatants from the rest of the civil population in the camp, that should also be done as soon as possible. And I think that is the concern of the international community, and these are the criticisms that are directed to the Sri Lankan government. However, there were achievements that are done, and we acknowledge them. We continue to work with the government to increase the number of people who are leaving the camps, elderly, over 60, pregnant women, handicapped, people in special needs in general. So far, 1,600 people were released. We managed to have site visit, relative and friends visits to visitation right to the camps. It happens in the case of Jaffna, some camps in Vabunia. We're asking for more. family unification to a certain extent accelerated during the last couple of weeks, and we're asking the government to share with us the registration records so that we can increase and accelerate the unification, family unification process. UNHCR, aside from the protection, monitoring, and advocating for those issues, we're also working on the shelter side of things, where us and 16 other shelter partners worked in the construction of a camp with a capacity of 27,000 people that is called Manique Farm Zone 3. And these are emergency temporary shelters and not the semi-permanent shelter. That is a government scheme. We're also working again in a, we're starting to work along the same line, emergency shelter in a second zone with a capacity of another 20,000 people. I must say the capacity of the government and ours at this point is under enormous pressure because of the number of people who are coming because of the adverse conditions, the physical condition in these areas where the government designated as camps. We also deliver non-food items, and these are basically the usual kitchen sets, clothing, plastic mats, tarpaulins, hygiene kits, clothing to IDBs, and have been massive distribution during the last few weeks and as people are coming back from the Vani. We still have challenges. And as I keep saying, as we receive people and we see them and we advocate with the government for their rights and their protection, I think the challenge more than those for those in the camps is the problems the civilian population is facing inside the Vani. The weather conditions are bad, rains, winds, wet grounds, limited supplies of food, medicine, and above all of this, of course, is a security situation. As the fighting between the LTTE and the government continues, the civilians are squeezed between two groups that are basically fighting. And our call again to the LTTE and to the government to use extreme cautions. Perhaps maybe I'll stop here and take any questions from the floor.
Okay. I think we'll go ahead then and have the other presentations and then open it up. So we turn now to Mike Owen from the Department of State. Thanks.
Thank you, and thanks for the invitation to be here today. I really appreciate that. I thought I would start with just a little summary of some of the things that have happened in the last 24 hours, and others may have other updates on that, and then talk a bit about steps that we are taking in the U.S. government to try to bring the conflict to a peaceful conclusion, but also spend some time thinking about and talking about the long run, because we think it's really critically important to look at the long run and how we can bring a more lasting sort of peace to Sri Lanka. Some of you may have heard very early today, Monday morning, some 35,000 civilians who were trapped in the safe zone managed to get out of the safe zone. They fled on foot to the west. Our reports, I spoke to our ambassador a couple of times this morning, our best reports are that there was a breach in the berm that was the LTT had built. The civilians were able to run out through that breach and reach safety. There was some firing across the boundary of the safe zone between the military and the LTT, but our best information is that the military did not actually enter into the safe zone. They were firing into the safe zone from outside, and these 35,000 civilians managed to flee. They are being processed by the Sri Lankan military, and our understanding is they're going to be put on buses and sent to these camps in Vavuniya, which we just heard about. That's going to put, obviously, an enormous strain on the resources in Vavuniya, 35,000 additional entrants, and, of course, there are many more probably on the way over the next couple of weeks. Separately, we also heard that a number of civilians also managed to flee by boat. 92 boats left the safe zone from the beach this morning. About 1,500 passengers were on those boats, and they have now been picked up by the Sri Lankan Navy. They are also being processed and sent to Vavuniya as well. So you have over 36,000 people soon arriving in Vavuniya. As we heard, the UNHCR is on the ground there to receive these civilians. We understand that food is there, some shelter is there. There could be an issue with potable water and with sanitation, and I know the UNHCR is working very hard to try to get the best sort of circumstance they can. So this is the most recent update that we've heard on what happened today. I think this is really especially significant, of course, because we've been hearing from the LTT on many occasions when we stressed the importance of allowing civilians to leave the safe zone. The LTT has often responded by saying the civilians don't want to leave, they want to stay because they're afraid of what might happen to them once they leave. I think this clearly shows that that is not the case. 35,000 civilians voted with their feet and did obviously want to risk a lot in order to leave. Just a few comments on what we're trying to do to help bring this to an end. I'm sure if you've been following Sri Lanka, you've seen that we've issued many statements over the last several months. The most recent one was issued by the State Department spokesperson Robert Wood on last Thursday, calling for both parties to implement an immediate humanitarian pause in the fighting to allow the international community to find a way to get the civilians out of the safe zone and to safety. Unfortunately, this was not heeded. The fighting has continued since the brief pause that was earlier last week, but we are continuing to call for a pause that will allow some sort of mechanism to get those remaining civilians out of harm's way. There are a lot of numbers that you hear on number of civilians. It's very difficult to know with precision how many are there. Our best estimates based on imagery, aerial imagery, is there's around 26 to 27,000 tents there in that area. And so if you make an assumption of maybe five people per tent, that would give you around 135, 140,000 civilians. But that's obviously an estimate. We don't know. It could be more, it could be fewer, but it's definitely fewer after the events of today. In terms of what else we're doing, there was a co-chairs, a conference call on Saturday morning. The Tokyo co-chairs comprise Japan, European Union, Norway, and the United States. This was a mechanism that was set up several years ago, first to look at sort of rebuilding, reconstruction of Sri Lanka in a post-conflict scenario, but is now, of course, focused on trying to bring the conflict to an end. You'll see probably a statement from the co-chairs tomorrow on the contents of that call, and we expect another call with follow-up on Wednesday of this week. Again, what we're continuing to push for is a humanitarian pause when we can find a way diplomatically to get these people who are trapped, civilians who are trapped in the zone, to safety. We've had repeated engagement with the government of Sri Lanka through our ambassador in Colombo, Bob Blake, who's been doing a great job, and of course with many people here in Washington as well, and at the UN and with like-minded colleagues. So we're continuing to pursue everything we can on the diplomatic front. The next steps, as I say, are to press for a pause in the fighting and to evacuate civilians. We also want to emphasize the importance of having international standards in these camps where the civilians are fleeing to. There's going to be a tremendous strain on these camps, and it's really imperative that we do, the international community, do everything possible to make sure that all of those camps meet fully international standards, that the international community, the UNHCR, other UN agencies, the ICRC, be directly involved in that, in monitoring the process and in helping to get those people resettled as quickly as possible. We're trying quietly, and I can't talk too much about this, but we are trying quietly behind the scenes to find a way to bring an end to the fighting. It's very difficult to see exactly how that's going to happen, but we think there are a couple of elements that need to be involved. We need to find a way for the LTT to surrender arms, possibly to a third party, in the context of a pause in the fighting, to surrender their arms in exchange for some sort of limited amnesty to at least some members of the LTT and the beginning of a political process. Now, those are pretty vague. That's a pretty vague outline, and we realize that it's going to require a lot of negotiation with the parties involved to bring that to fruition in a really a coherent way, but that is something that is underway behind the scenes to try to find a way to reach that point. So that's sort of where we are on our current diplomatic efforts. But as I said, I think it's really important to look longer term. We, of course, have designated the LTT as a terrorist organization, and we certainly have no sympathy for some of the things that they've carried out. But I think you do have to ask the very legitimate question, why did they have a following in the beginning? And I think it's because some in the Tamil community do have legitimate grievances. And we need to find, I think it's imperative for Sri Lankans to find a way to give everyone in the community, all Sri Lankans, a legitimate voice in their government. And so we want to support the government of Sri Lanka as they move forward in an effort to do exactly that. I think it's important that Sri Lanka move toward really a strong democratic governance in a multi-ethnic society in which all groups have a voice in that society. So the devolution of power to the provinces as envisioned in the 13th Amendment, that's something we feel is very important as a first step, but it needs to go beyond that. There are going to be a lot of civil society challenges in the next several years in dealing with the aftermath of this conflict and making sure that a conflict doesn't reignite as a result of mistakes that are made now. So we want to work closely with the government in that way. And I would emphasize that we believe the diaspora, the Sri Lankan diaspora, in particular the Tamil diaspora in North America and Europe elsewhere, have a very important role to play in this. They should, I hope, be speaking out in terms of what they envision for Sri Lanka in a post-conflict scenario. They have an important voice in that process. Just to go through some of the specific steps we envision over the next, probably next couple of years, I've sort of spoken about the short-term measures, humanitarian pause, getting civilians out of the way, helping to find some way, some mechanism for the conflict to end through a surrendering of arms and some sort of amnesty. But once the conflict ends, there are several other things we envision doing as quickly as possible. One is demining. That's going to be critically important as the LTT has dropped back over the last several months, a couple of years. They have left mines in many, many locations throughout northern Sri Lanka. I don't think anyone knows exactly where those mines are, so there's not a map there to find where we have to go and demine. So that's going to be a tremendous undertaking. We're already talking with some of our counterparts in other countries and other NGOs, NGO community, to try to put together a coherent effort in which we can get a lot of resources on the ground in a hurry to help the government of Sri Lanka demine the northern part of the country. We've already identified $10 million we're prepared to put to this right away, and we hope to have additional resources subsequently. I think that's very important to do that right away so that there's no excuse for people staying in camps any longer than they have to. People can get back to their villages and their towns wherever they were, and that's very important. We want to work with the international community and the government of Sri Lanka to resettle refugees as quickly as possible. I mentioned civil society challenges. I think you're going to see a lot during that resettlement effort because inevitably, if you're resettling, say, 150,000 people, some people are going to go back to their home and find that somebody else is living in their house. Some people are going to go back and find that somebody's farming their land. So finding a way to resolve those disputes quickly and judiciously, I think, will be a very big challenge and one that we want to support the government in their efforts to do that. We also want to work, as I said, with the international community. We find it very important that the international community play an absolutely central role in this resettlement. The government of Sri Lanka has committed to resettling 80% of the refugees by year's end. We'd like to help them reach that goal. We think that's a very laudable goal if they can reach that, and we'll certainly try to support them. Excuse me. I would also urge the government of Sri Lanka to grant visas to people who are coming to Sri Lanka to try and help, members of the ICRC, other international organizations, make sure they can get there and provide the help, because to deal with this number of displaced persons, it's going to require a concerted international effort. Another thing that has to happen pretty quickly as people are being resettled is voter registration and national ID cards, making sure that everyone has an identity and that everyone who's eligible to vote is registered to vote. That's going to be critically important. Some people have been displaced for quite some length of time. Making sure they're resettled and registered to vote is going to be critical to future democracy. We want to work with everyone to make sure that we have a program of voter education, election logistics and monitoring of elections, because elections will come. They'll have to come sooner rather than later, we hope. And we want to make sure that the elections are free and fair and that all Sri Lankans have a credible voice in choosing who their future leadership will be. We hope to see the rise of maybe some new voices in the Tamil community, moderate voices in the north. We think that's very, very important, and we want to work with the Tamil community, and I think here especially the diaspora has a very important role to play in helping build a sort of new set of moderate Tamil voices in the north. Rebuilding infrastructure and civil society, that's something that's going to be very important. We're doing that to a limited degree in the east now, and we hope to be able to do the same thing on a larger scale in the north in the future. And then we're going to need to continue to press on a number of important issues, rights issues. Most, I would say one of the most important is press freedom. there have been a lot of attacks on media in Sri Lanka. We need to make sure that journalists are protected and that the media is able to report effectively what's going on throughout the country. We think that's very important. And as I said earlier, we're going to press for and hope that the government will agree to implement the 13th Amendment as envisioned as quickly as possible. I'd just like to say in closing a couple of things. I've talked a lot about the Sinhalese community, Tamil community. I think we need to realize that Sri Lanka is a much more complex place than that. We've had some meetings with the Tamil diaspora in North America, and even there they have great differences of opinion, different viewpoints. Certainly within a society like like Sri Lanka, there are many people with many different viewpoints and voices. I think the key is that everyone has a voice. Everyone has a legitimate voice and can be heard. There's also a large Muslim community, of course, in Sri Lanka. They need to be heard as well. So I think we need to be careful about not reducing everything to Tamil versus Sinhalese, but recognize the sort of multicultural character of Sri Lankan society. And just in closing, I'd like to pay a compliment to the international community, the international organizations like the UNHCR, NGOs like Human Rights Watch, and others who have done, I think, a great job in a very difficult situation. We'll continue to support these organizations. we are one of the largest donors for, certainly for food relief to the displaced persons, and we'll continue to provide that support in the future. So I think I'll stop there and be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Mike. Certainly raising a lot of issues ranging from the present situation in the Vani through longer term reconstruction. We turn now to Muthu Krishna, please.
Okay, thank you very much. I'll just briefly update or complement what my previous speaker said. From some field-level information my staff had gathered in the past few months, because I've been physically here since last October, so I do not have a first-hand knowledge, but we do have staff in Vaunia, Jaffna in the north, and in Batticaloa and Ampara in the east. So I'll today focus only on the north. There are people, the people who are fleeing the north fire zone of from the Vani in general, are not only coming to Vaunia, but there are also people going to Jaffna Peninsula, although lesser number of people. And relatively, you can access, we are able to access them much more freely than we could, our staff could do in Vaunia. Our staff have been talking to a lot of the people who are in camps in like Kaidadi, Kopai, in Tanmarachi and Maligamam areas of the peninsula. And also, we also know information from, there are satellite telephone calls made from the people still holed up in the no-fire zone to their kith and kin or friends in the peninsula as well as in other parts of the country, including Colombo and other places. So there is some kind of information we are having. LTT's economy in the Vani or even in the narrow strip of area has not completely collapsed. They seem to be still believing that they could reemerge out of the ashes. That's what their belief is, whether we believe it or not. And they are making good business out of some of this misery as well. Apparently, they are charging three sovereigns of gold to build a bunker for a family, for example. I mean, each sovereign is 8 grams, so 3 sovereigns is 24 grams of gold. Because it's high cost, people don't have that much liquid cash, so they take from jewelry, mainly women's jewelry, in turn for building bunkers for the people who are holed up there. For example, satellite telephone calls, they are charging rupees 1,000 per minute to call anywhere in the world, because that's a flat charge. And also fish, for example, is selling at rupees 3,000 a kilogram. Then I inquired, how could people at this stage afford this? There is still money flows from abroad. For example, people, the kith and kin or friends of those families living in Western countries, give money to some LTT front organizations in these countries, and then through satellite phones, they pass the message to the other end, and the LTT itself disperses in rupees. So that kind of the, what we call undial in Tamil, or hawala hundi in South Asia, or in English, it's just money laundering. So that kind of an economy is still ongoing. So I also questioned some of my staff, what are they trying to achieve by amassing all this money at this late stage, because their life itself is virtually threatened. There are two possible reasons. One is that they're still at least top level, and there is hardly a middle level now. There is more or less top level leadership, and also very raw recruits, recently recruited people who put into the front line to safeguard the border areas, not to allow the people to flee, etc. So still hope among the top leaders that they would come up out of these recent defeats some way or the other, either through their own fight back or through some international intervention. So there is some hope. And on the other hand, also, it could be also the reason that the leaderships hold on their cadres itself as very much waned. So there is not much of a tight control as they usually had for a very long time. So therefore, maybe some of the lower rung leaders are making this money and sending this money out of the area through people who are fleeing the area to government control areas. So those could be two possible explanations. We also hear that the treatment of people who are fleeing the areas to the government control areas, whether to the Jaffna Peninsula or to the Waimea, that there is a considerable amount of sexual harassment of women by the Sri Lankan armed forces. Relatively, I hear that police are behaving better than the army personnel. And whenever women soldiers are trying to check women civilians, sometimes they are forcibly sidelined by men soldiers, and they want to check themselves for whatever reason. So although because of the social stigma, they're not speaking out publicly, but some of this information they have told to some of their close relatives. Of course, we don't have too much of detail yet. And also, to my understanding, government does not acknowledge it, but to whatever information we have, they are still not only in the no-fire zone. Apparently, there are small areas of thickly forested jungle areas where still LTT's presence is there, along with a considerable amount of civilians as human shield. There are two evidence we have gathered so far for that. Is I think a few weeks ago, perhaps Mr. Aminawad could corroborate this fact, that they did attack a convoy of food items taken through the ANI into the peninsula. So they could not have, they shelled basically. So they could not have shelled from the northeastern coast of the no-fire zone. So it could have been closer to the A9. So our hunch is that it's somewhere around Odisutan, between the A9 and Odisutan area. I know personally that from a long time ago. There are very much thickly forested jungle areas in those areas. So there may be, and also there is another evidence for that is that some of the people who have called their families through satellite phones to Jaffna had, of course, they couldn't tell precisely where it is. Of course, all these calls are monitored by LTTE people because they are the ones who are having these satellite phones and letting people use for 1,000 rupees a minute. 1,000 rupees is about $8 to $9 at current exchange rate per minute. But they have said that, say for example, 2 weeks ago we heard that some people calling their family and saying that they have brought up a satellite phone just now. So there were about 300 people waiting in the queue to call their kids and kin, not only in Sri Lanka but also abroad. So these are some of the evidence we have that it is not only there are certain areas still army has the armed forces have not been able to still go because perhaps they don't have the physical human power to really go into those areas yet other than the no-fly zone. So this is some of this factual information latest what we get from the ground. Okay, as far as the survival of the TTE, I have a feeling like past 6 months I've been following the diaspora activities of the diaspora communities in Europe, North America, as well as in India, for example, India and Malaysia as well. They have much more sympathy and support among the diaspora community than within the country itself. So there are a whole lot of reasons for that. I don't have time to go into that. But that is a fact. So I'm personally not against any kind of a humanitarian, whatever you call it, humanitarian pause or the ceasefire or whatever, to release, get these civilians out of the of the clutches of the LTTE. But then that does not provide a lifeline to LTTE. LTTE has, throughout this conflict, survived. Fortunately, from their point of view, unfortunately, from the point of view of the Tamil community, that similar kind of dire situations. First one was in 1987 when the Sri Lankan army itself tried to wrest control of the Vadamarachi area of the Jaffna Peninsula from the LTTE, then India directly intervened. And I don't want to go into the whole history of that. Second time, the Indian peacekeeping force, which was stationed between 87 and late 89, virtually eliminated LTTE. This was confessed by the leader of the LTTE itself. Their numbers shrunk to 50, but fortunately for them, unfortunately for Sri Lanka, then President gave a lifeline to them and asked the Indian peacekeeping force to leave the country. So that was the second chance they had to escape from almost virtual elimination. So this is, I think, after 20 years, their second weakest position since late 89, to best of my understanding. And I don't think Tamil people, at least who are in Sri Lanka, whether in the northeast of Sri Lanka or other parts of Sri Lanka, would like LTTE to prolong for another 5, 10, or even 20 years, because that will be disastrous for the Tamil community. They eliminated all democratic political leaderships, intellectuals, physically, or they have forced them out into exile. Okay, there is hyperactivity, as Mr. Michael Owen suggested, among the international community to somehow resolve this issue, but from the LTTE's point of view, it's a life and death struggle. Unlike in the East, similar situation arose in Wahare when they were cornered in Wahare. They were holding onto the population, but eventually they let them go because they could always run to Vani. But this is a kind of a life and death struggle. But I also have to say that a significant number of them have already dispersed throughout the world in the past 2 years. It started during the ceasefire time. The close relatives of the LTTE hierarchy had moved to the Western countries as refugees or whatever. And even in the past 2 years, middle-level and low-level cadres have moved, including to India, Tamil Nadu. I know the names of some of them as well. So they're spread out in Europe, North America, India, Singapore, Malaysia, etc. So they still have armed people, well-trained armed people abroad. So they could still, this is the hope they have, even if the top leadership is eliminated physically in the coming months, that somehow they would come back sometime in the future from some foreign land. I mean, there are also talks of they have got into places like Myanmar. You know, bulk of Myanmar is out of control of the government of Myanmar, so and also Thai border as well. So this have to be taken into account. So it is not a sort of an international conflict. I mean, it has been always quite well internationalized, but more so in the past few months because of very hyperactivity of the diaspora community. So I don't want to go into much more detail, but I'm also aware that the special representative of the UN Secretary General, Mr. Vijay Nambiar, is in Colombo for the last few days, and also he is said to be exploring possibility of meeting the some of the leadership of the LTT personally in the no-fire zone. But I have to, from my personal understanding of the leadership of the LTT and deep knowledge from my childhood, it would be very dangerous for any foreigner, let alone a special representative of the UN, to physically go in there. Any other lines of communication is fine, but because they could become a hostage, and it would be a real, it will create a real international crisis if that happens, because that could be the best human shield they could get for their leader. There are two, three people at the top who are looking for such high-profile targets to take hostage, because all these ordinary civilians are nothing for them, you know. But if a foreigner, especially a special representative of the UN or any other organization, is caught up as a hostage, then there is no way out. Now I'll just throw some things on the political process, what our representative from the State Department said. I mean, this is where the government is weak, I think. I think majority, or silent, what I would call the silent majority of the Tamil people, including in the diaspora, let me say that, despite their hyper-activism of Tamil diaspora in the past few months, the silent majority is quite reasonable, conform to democratic norms, and want democracy back in the northern and eastern part of Sri Lanka. So therefore, there need to be attempt to tap on this kind of population, whatever LTT prefers to do, whether it wants to join the democratic mainstream or not, it doesn't matter. To me, as long as the leader, at least two or three leaders, are alive, it's very difficult for them to enter political mainstream. The leader himself, Velpre Prabhakaran, the intelligence chief, Puthuamman, and the Sea Tiger leader, Susai. There are some conflicting information about whether Susai, the Sea Tiger leader, is still alive or not, but I'm not sure 100%. But at least Puthuamman, Prabhakaran with his eldest son, is still in that area. People have seen them. So until they are physically alive, it's very. I don't think they will give up. I did listen to a radio interview, to an Australian radio interview given by one Yogaratnam Yogi, who used to be a spokesperson for the former LTT's political wing leader, Mahathir, who was assassinated. So he keeps on saying, it was in Tamil though, it was quite a 1 hour and 3 minutes speech. I did listen to that 2 days ago. They're still intransigent in a sense. So they're still hoping that things will turn around and they would come out of this virtual extinction. So, yeah, on the Sri Lankan side, yes, Eastern I do not think that, of course, the government's attitude is that the so-called model is this, they want to revive democracy in the northern province in the model of Eastern province. But I hardly see any kind of positive things, not any, I would say, but people are not still satisfied that there is real democracy in the Eastern Province. A lot of internal conflict within the ruling party in the Eastern Province itself. Pillayan versus Karuna is a major factor, and the chief minister of the Eastern Province is complaining constantly about lack of resources to undertake any meaningful activities, etc., etc. And also among the, even from the Eastern general public, there is not much of sympathy, or despite the fact that they have won the elections, however flawed that may be, we don't want to go into detail, but I don't think they have that much of a sort of a durable legitimacy as a democratic representatives of the Eastern people. So if that kind of a model is going to be replicated in the North, I don't think. And also, we have to remember that North is much different from the East in a sense. East is a multi-ethnic community. There's a strong Muslim community there, so there is always some kind of flexibility room for the government to manipulate or negotiate. But in the North, it's a kind of a mono-ethnic conflict now. Of course, there was a significant amount of Muslim population who were driven out by the LTT in 1990. So I think giving power to sort of former armed groups is not the best way. I mean, if they are properly in a free and fair election, if they are really elected by the people, we have no objection. But I don't think that is that was the case in the East, and I don't think that would be the case in the North, at least in the interim situation. So I think, and also there is to win over the hearts and minds of the Tamil minority, not only within Sri Lanka, but also in the diaspora, Sri Lankan government should think beyond this narrow vision of a unitary state. Of course, nobody could have a sort of a strong feeling for a unitary state or a federal, quasi-federal kind of state, but that is open for negotiation. That should be open for even government should not hesitate to go for a referendum to ask the people of the Northern East or even throughout the country. I mean, I wouldn't say that referendum should be restricted to the Northern East, but throughout the country, what kind of state they would like to see Sri Lanka in 5 or 10 years down the road, whether they still want to maintain the unitary status of the federal state. I mean, federal does not mean that a particular model of federalism. There are various forms of federalism. It could be even within the current 13th Amendment, whereby the provincial councils are set up and the provincial government. We, Sri Lanka, of course, people would say that, yeah, Sri Lanka has rectified, the government has rectified a lot of the injustices done to the minority community since independence. For example, language rights, where Sinhala was made the official language in 56, but in the mid-80s, Tamil also has been made official language. In paper, yes, it looks fine. The implementation is very weak. Even I still get letters in language which I can't read, although I can read a little bit of, I can talk a little bit of Sinhala, but I can't. So implementation is very weak. So I think in the same way, I think a lot of the Western countries, including the US, which has outlawed LTTE, but still they are carrying on with their activities, I know, in the suburbs of DC as well as within DC, in terms of collection of money, mobilization of even arms, I wouldn't want to go into detail, and things are still going on in Canada more so, and in UK more so than in the US. So the same way that the implementation, enforcement of the outlawing of the LTTE in these countries are weak, a similar kind of situation exists in Sri Lanka, whereas some of the past long-lasting legitimate grievances or injustices have been rectified, but the implementation has been weak thus far. So I think government and the donor committee should concentrate on that kind of implementation. Of course, from the Tamil political side, they have to really look, take a deep introspection of their whole politics in the post-1977 period. I mean, Tamil politics had a long democratic tradition. Only time when they were thrown out of parliament in 82, I think, through an amendment where the then government outlawed separation, any party calling for separation So the Tamil Democratic Mainstream Party, TLF, was virtually thrown out of the parliament because they did not want to take an oath saying that they would not canvass for a separate state. So since then, whether it's Indian government or the Norwegian government or the co-chairs, everybody have been banking on one rebel group or the other. And so the for ex, so-called ex-militant groups or ex-armed groups versus the LTTE. I think that has to change. From as an ethnic Tamil, I think we have to go back to our old political mainstream democratic political parties where we did not have any violence. We did not use arms for addressing our grievances or anything like that. So I'll stop there, basically, yeah. So I'm not too comfortable. I mean, not only myself, I think. I also have a lot of connection with Tamil diaspora groups in the UK and Europe because I lived in the UK for about 10 years between late 80s to late 90s. So I know that diaspora group much more than the North American diaspora group. And also from the field in the past 10 years, I've been entirely based in Sri Lanka. So during the peacetime, we had access to people not only in government control areas, but also in the LTTE control areas. So they would like real democracy. Even within Jaffna Peninsula, for example, although LTTE is more or less wiped out, another armed group, which is aligned with the government. Of course, they may deny that they are armed group, they are a mainstream political party, they have a member, there is a minister who is in the cabinet. But still, like say, they are taxing people, businesses, for example, not people, they are taxing businesses as the same way as the LTTE has been doing. So because of this kind of thing, I feel that Tamil people do not have much confidence in these so-called ex-militant groups as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Muthu Krishna. We turn now to Anna Heistad. Please, Anna.
Thank you. I'll try to be brief because I do want to leave some time for your questions. And I will actually go back to what's happening right now because I think at this point this is something we all should be mostly concerned about. And as much as Human Rights Watch has been involved in working in Sri Lanka for many years, and I hope we'll stay engaged. At this point, we're mostly concerned about what's going to happen to these thousands of civilians trapped in a small piece of land in Devani. The information we receive is very close to what you've heard already. We stay in touch with people inside the no-fire zone, as well as people who are in Vavuni on the receiving end of people who are managing to escape, plus international organizations who are somewhat close to the area. We ourselves have conducted several missions to Sri Lanka over the last months, so I think we have a pretty good information, as much as it's possible under the circumstances, and I'll get back to that in the end of my statement a little bit more. But for now, what we are hearing is that it is unclear whether the army has entered the no-fire zone, but the fighting was pretty serious, apparently, because as of today, the hospital, there was one functioning makeshift hospital in Putumatalan, and this hospital is apparently closed. The medical personnel did not return to this hospital because the fighting was very heavy in the area, and all of the patients are gone. It's not clear where exactly they are, whether they were transferred to any other hospital, whether they were just taken to their homes. That's most likely what happened. In two other, I mean, they're not even makeshift hospitals, but areas where people were somehow collected for medical treatment, closer to the south of the no-fire zone. Today, there were 330 wounded and 60 killed. And according to everybody we spoke to, these numbers are just a small fraction of the actual casualties. Because given that there are no medical facilities whatsoever, most killed and most of the wounded are simply not being brought there. Which for us is an extremely alarming situation, especially given that the government, as you all probably know, have announced the final deadline for LTTE to surrender. This final deadline is noon April 21st, which is about 10 hours from now. And this is particularly alarming given that we're going back to the number of people who are trapped in this area because the government says that 3,500 managed to escape over the last couple of days. which leaves us with about 15,000, according to government estimates, because the latest we heard from the government over the last 2 weeks was the number of people trapped in the area is 50,000 people. Now, if we look at the estimates by the international community, as cited previously on this panel, we're talking about most likely more than 100,000. So the difference is quite significant, and it becomes even more significant when we talk about what's the final assault is going to be like. So if by tomorrow noon we hear that another 15,000 people manage to escape to the government-controlled areas, the government would assume that everybody remaining in the area is LTT cadre and is thus fair game, which we do not believe is true, and we're extremely concerned for the fate of the civilians and what's going to happen to them. We are concerned that it's going to be a bloodbath, as was pointed out by other international experts before, and we do think that essentially international community has about 10 hours to make it crystal clear to both sides of this conflict, LTT and the government of Sri Lanka, that they will not get away with that, that unnecessary and unlawfully lost civilians' lives would be considered war crimes, and people who are responsible for that, including commanders, will be held accountable for that. In terms of, I think, you know, one of the issues that has been sort of touched upon here is the whole humanitarian assistance. We also have to remember that people inside the no-fire zone are dying and suffering not just because they're being shot at and prevented from leaving by LTT and not because they're being shelled, but also because of severe malnutrition and lack of assistance. And I have to say, this is not accidental because, as was briefly mentioned by my co-panelists, since September 2008, the government banned all international organizations, humanitarian agencies, from Vani, and as of now, there is not a single international person present in this area. ICRC was the only agency that was allowed to approach the area, but not inland. They were only allowed to evacuate people. And from information we received as of today, the last food convoy came in about 10 days ago. So at this point, the food shortage is really, really acute. And in terms of medical supplies, they're pretty much non-existent. I think some of you, I mean, we posted some of the photographs that we received from the no-fire zone of seriously malnourished children and adults, and I think they're a very good illustration of what's happening there. I would just very briefly touch on the camps, because obviously when we're talking about what we're talking about right now is, I think we probably passed the point where meaningful humanitarian ceasefire is possible. I really don't think that at this point anything will stop Sri Lankan army from advancing. The question is, how will they advance? And to what extent civilians will be spared, as they're supposed to under international law, during this advance? But the other question is, what's going to happen to people who did manage to escape to the government-controlled areas? As much as we put full blame on LTT for not allowing people to leave, we did call it human shielding. We did say that human shielding is a war crime. However, I think we also have to remember that many people were not leaving not just because they were physically prevented from leaving by LTT, but because of massive LTT propaganda, which unfortunately had a lot to do with reality on the other side, because people who managed to escape are being kept in de facto internment camps, no matter what the government calls them, welfare villages, transit sites. These are de facto internment camps where people are denied any kind of freedom of movement. The camps are surrounded by layers, coils of barbed wire, and, you know, I did check today whether the barbed wire is still there, and it is, and whether the military presence is still there, and it is. It did decrease somewhat due to certain international pressure, but it is still there. And just today, just, you know, I was just checking my email and, you know, received a response from one of the humanitarian workers who works in these camps, and she was talking a lot about how people are terrified of talking to anybody from the outside. There was apparently a journalist tour to one of the camps a couple of days ago, and people were told not just not to complain about any of the conditions, but also praise the presence of barbed wire and say that it's for their safety and they love the sight of it. So we are aware that there are certain improvements, and largely to the work done by UNHCR. But of course, you know, when we're talking about people who have been released, whatever it is, 600 people, we have to remember that about 97% of the people have been in these camps for the last 3 months, and there is pretty much no end in sight. As you might have noticed from Mr. Awad's statement, there are still no registration lists. We do not know what's happening in the screening procedures. We know that finally, about a month ago, I believe UNHCR and ICRC were allowed at the final screening checkpoint at Omantai before the people come into government into these camps in Vavunia. But there are several other as people cross to the government-controlled areas. There is a big screening process in Kilinochi, from everything we understand, and nobody knows what's happening there. When I was in Vavunia in February, every day there were reports of families who ended up in Vavunia while their relatives were kept behind, at that point at Omantai, because at that point there was no presence in Omantai and in Kilinochi. And today, pretty much, we don't know what's happening, what has happened with these people. Given Sri Lanka's pretty appalling record on disappearances, and that's something I worked on very closely, we are extremely concerned about the complete lack of transparency. As much as we fully understand the need for the screening procedures and you know, both as people cross and immediately after, but we do not believe that there is any justification for keeping people in indefinite internment in these camps. As of now, the situation in hospitals apparently gets worse because many of the wounded, again, it's just from the email I just received from one of the workers who has access to the hospital. The hospital in Vavunia is completely overcrowded because buses of people with severe injuries are being delivered there. And at this point, it is not clear to what extent NGOs will be able to assist those in the hospital. At the point when I was there in February, NGOs were not allowed anywhere near the hospital, and the government was claiming that they can deal with everything on their own. I know that the situation has improved somewhat, but the big question mark is what's going to happen now that the influx is so large. My final remark would be about the issue of access, and I think it's becoming as crucial as ever. I have to say, you know, as you've heard from, you know, my brief introduction, I've worked in many conflict areas around the world, and in many areas that can be considered sort of closed countries where the governments really don't want the outside world to know what's happening. And I have to say, Sri Lanka is pretty unprecedented. This is probably the first time in my career that I could not get into an IDP camp. It is incredible and incredibly cynical how Sri Lankan government managed to completely close these areas off from outside scrutiny. As you know, there are absolutely no journalists anywhere near the area of fighting. And again, think of some other conflicts that are happening in the world right now. There are very few where the situation is similar. Forget the Vani, forget the no-fire zone. Journalists are not allowed anywhere near Vavunia. They cannot, no outside observer can get into Vavunia town without an MOD clearance. I don't know if you were following British papers at all, but one of the very prominent British journalists, whom I know very well, was just not allowed to get into the country. He was turned away at the airport. Another British journalist tried to get to the hospital in Pulmadai and to Vavunia and was turned away at every single point. At the same time, as you know, Sri Lankan, I don't want to go into this whole area issue because it's huge, but we have to remember that all of that is happening, again, is the background of crackdown on civil society in Sri Lanka more broadly. So we cannot really rely on Sri Lankan civil groups, civil society groups and journalists to report much from the area. And finally, from everything we understand, relief agencies and local NGOs and church groups were pretty much all threatened into silence, very effectively so. The government has been playing the access versus silence card very, very effectively. So we are not hearing as much as we would have heard from the UN, from from, I don't know, Médecins Sans Frontières and other organizations that otherwise would have talked. And I think this situation is absolutely unacceptable, and I think anybody, the first question that anybody should be asking the Sri Lankan government is, if everything is so good as the government is saying, why are they trying to hide it so badly? I have to say that there have been some serious attempts from the international community to influence the situation, including the U.S. government, which we definitely welcome. And I do think that the fact that the situation is not worse and that there are people still alive in the no-fire zone is largely due to these international interventions. But we do not think that overall the response has been adequate. And of course, you know, we on our behalf are currently looking at, you know, at, for several several things. I mean, there are key governments that need to take a much stronger stance on what's happening. For example, Japan. Japan is one of, well, is the top bilateral donor to Sri Lanka. And unless Japanese government takes a stronger stance on the situation, and we hope that maybe, I mean, I do not know to what extent the U.S. government can go ahead and encourage some stronger action on behalf of the other governments. That would to make sure that the message is consistent throughout the international community. And we do believe that it's high time for the UN to start discussing a possibility of a commission of inquiry into war crimes committed by both sides. I'll stop here. And
thank you, Anna, and thanks to all the panelists for a sobering and realistic assessment of a very complex situation. We have time now for questions. In the interest of time, I'm going to suggest that we group two or three together and then give the panelists a chance to respond. Let's start back here. One, and then two, and then three. One, two, three. Mm-hmm. And could you please identify yourself?
Sure. My name is Dan Brady. I'm with CSIS. Thank you, all of you, for a very interesting presentation. I wanted to ask you to comment on the nature of the obstacle that Sinhala Buddhist nationalism presents to the peace process, both in the short term, in terms of assuring Tamil civilians in the north adequate human rights, and in the long term, for example, getting the Sri Lankan government to concede politically, like implementing the 13th Amendment fully. I was in Sri Lanka in 2006 for 5 months, and again for another 4 months last fall, and I was disturbed to see that kind of the rhetoric of this is a Sinhala Buddhist island, Tamils are guests here, that sort of thing, especially in the south, was getting worse, not better. There was less of a sense, in my mind, among Sinhala Sri Lankans, especially in the south, that there was a need to concede. If anything, this the sense that the war militarily was going well for the government meant that there was less political concession necessary. So I would just be interested to hear any comment that you had about that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And this gentleman here.
I really thank the Red Cross and the Doctors Without Borders who are serving there.
Could you please identify yourself?
Dr. Sam Elangovan from Philadelphia. The United Nations, the U.S. government, United Kingdom, everybody has been asking and asking and asking, and all the answers seem to be only chemical bombs and cluster bombs in the so-called safe zone and where people are living. In spite of all the diplomatic words, have you done anything to stop this instead of talking what happened before? And the second question is, I'm glad, Mr. Owens, you are listening to all the other Tamil diaspora who have been personally affected and not just listening to some blabbering, biased experts, so-called experts. Can you answer, please, how can these communities live together in future? They can live only as slaves and masters. Do you see a possibility of these communities living together as equals?
Thank you. And then we had a woman right here.
Hi, my name is Rosha Habsa. I'm with People for Equality and Relief in Lanka. You know, in the past couple of months, several powerful countries have called for an immediate ceasefire, including the U.S. and the U.N. And I'm just wondering what kind of consequences or measures will be taken against the government of Sri Lanka should they continue attacks on safe zones, which it sounds like is going to get worse by the time we go to bed tonight. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And the woman right in front, and then we'll give the panelists a chance to respond.
Hi, I'd especially like to thank the last speaker because I think the urgency of the situation is terrifying, and I think it's very unfortunate that my name is Lisa Hansen. I'm a student at SAIS and worked on Sri Lanka human rights issues. And the immediate concern, and I think it's really tragic how there's been a lack of international media attention largely, and I think the urgency cannot be understated. And one of the questions being, as the State Department has also confirmed that it seems pretty inevitable now of with this deadline that there are going to be a lot more people dead and a lot more people in camps who aren't dead. And again, we didn't hear much from the UNHCR about the quality of the camps, and I appreciate Ms. Neistat for touching on that, but you already are over capacity, you mentioned, and there's not freedom, there's not access for humanitarian workers, and how do you propose, both with your constraints and the State Department and NGOs, to help facilitate, once this deadline has passed, accommodating people who are in the camps?
Thank you. Okay, we've got a number of questions on Buddhist nationalists. What can be done to stop? How can communities live together? Consequences following ceasefire and the quality of camps. Who would like to jump in? Who would like to jump in?
Well, I'll say a couple.
Well, I have Seema then.
Go ahead.
I mentioned when I was speaking that Sri Lanka is a very diverse country, and you can't just, you shouldn't sort of simplify things as the Tamil Sinhalese. It's a much more diverse and complex multi-ethnic country than that, and there certainly are elements of very strong Sinhala national Buddhist nationalism at work in Sri Lanka. I think it requires political leadership to bring those diverse elements of a multi-ethnic, multicultural society together in a coherent way. And so I think that's what is going to be required, strong political leadership at the top to say we want to maintain Sri Lankan unity, and to do so we need to find a way that all of the people in Sri Lanka can live together. Without that strong political leadership at the very top, I think Sri Lanka is going to face continuing problems. So I think that's really the only answer as far as I'm concerned. You have to have strong leadership with the support of the international community, and the international community holding that political leadership responsible for the consequences of what happens. On chemical weapons and cluster bombs, we've of course seen these reports. We're very concerned about that. We have made it clear to the government of Sri Lanka that this would be totally unacceptable. We have tried to find evidence of the use of chemical weapons and cluster bombs, and we have not been able to find such evidence. But if anyone can provide that, we'd be very interested. There are, I know, a lot of stories, but we have still not been able to find any evidence that either of those weapons are being used by either side at this stage. And someone asked about consequences if the government of Sri Lanka does attack the safe zone and large numbers of civilians are killed. Certainly there would be consequences, and we've made it very clear to the leadership of the government of Sri Lanka there would be strong consequences if that occurred. I would not want to sort of tie our hands in terms of specifying exactly what those consequences would be, but we would certainly hold the government of Sri Lanka responsible for the death of a lot of civilians, and we've made that very clear to the leadership.
Thank you, Amin.
Right, on the camp, just adding to what I have said earlier, and then thanks to Human Rights Watch for also highlighting some of these issues as far as screening at Omantai, where we have access along with ICRC, but unfortunately we do not have access to the IDBs themselves. So we're asking the government again, while we gained access physically to Omantai, we were not able to have access to the IDBs themselves. And the military people at the checkpoint to advocate for that. The last communication I have received from the government is that UNHCR will be given access together with the Ministry of Social Services, who are responsible for people in special need, which is fine. We don't have that expertise within the organization. And they have a very good system in Sri Lanka as far as the Ministry of Social Services and their internal laws that are governing handling of elderly people, of children, people in special needs. So I welcome that, and time will tell if we get access this time around. As to the other conditions that we have laid out in the Memorandum of Understanding and the aid memoir to the government back in September, and then in January, as the people started coming, we said we will give the emergency 3 months period to see how the government will address some of the concerns that we have floated along with the international community on the basic and principles as far as the conditions of the IDBs in the camps. That 3 month period started on the 2nd of February, so it goes until the beginning of May. But we did not want to wait until the 3 months are over. What we did is we undertook an assessment, an inventory of achievement and the deficit, and we have sent a memorandum to the government at the highest level, And we have shared it with our fellow UN agencies and Special Representative, Secretary General for Human Rights of IDBs, Mr. Walter Killian. We shared it with Under Secretary General Holmes. We shared it with many of the donor countries that are represented in Sri Lanka and they're concerned about the situation of the IDBs. Now it is very, the situation as far as achievement and deficit is very clear in black and white. And we put it before the government to act on it. We welcome the initiatives that are taken by the government, although the numbers are negligible compared to of the people released from the camps, whatever category of special need they are, negligible if compared to the tens of thousands that are in the camp. And the basic principle of freedom of movement has to be met one way or another by registering everybody, by screening people, and we could help with the screening. And it shouldn't be then a collective punishment. That is our stand, and we will forcefully advocate that. And the government, we are transparent with the government. The government is transparent with us. So we'll continue to put these issues forward.
Thank you. I think we have time for another round of questions. Maybe we'll start toward the back. This woman here.
Thank you. Miriam Young with the U.S. Council on Sri Lanka, and I have two questions. One is for Mr. Awad. Sir John Holmes and Walter Kalin have made multiple trips to Sri Lanka, and they've been given quite a series of promises by the government in terms of the running of the camps and what's happening with the IDPs. However, almost none of those promises have been kept. And I wonder what exactly your plan is, given that you can continue to ask the government for these things, but it has not happened. Second, I have just a question for Mr. Sarvanandan. And you have talked about post-conflict situation and the hope that there will be moderate Tamil leaders coming up and truly working for democracy. And I wonder if you could, how do you envision that? Given that the reasons for the actual armed insurgency came about because the original grievances never were addressed. And at this point, whatever Tamil groups there are all armed. Thank you.
Thank you. And we have one over here.
Hi, my name is Melissa Famula, and I'm a graduating master's student at SAIS. I'm focusing in international law. Thank you very much for presenting today. And I had a question based on what Mr. Owen mentioned, which was the possibility of exchanging arms for amnesty. And I was wondering what the other panel's perspectives were, the likelihood that that would occur, and the repercussions of that on the civil society after it, hopefully, that this ends. Thank you.
Thank you. And the last one in this round, yes, right here.
My name is Neville Laduheti. The question is to Mr. Owen. You advocated a pause in the conflict to permit the civilians to leave. Given the fact that the civilians are being used as a human shield by the LTTE, they would naturally do everything in their power to prevent them from leaving. And even the current 35,000 that left was because there was a positive breach made in a bond, and that would not have been possible unless the army intervened and brought that about. Therefore, the expecting of, to release the civilians or for them to leave through a pause is a highly unlikely event, considering the fact that they are going to be kept trapped by the LTTE. A related fact you also mentioned was that they would be, you are planning to come to some arrangement where they will surrender and their arms and arrange it for some kind of amnesty. Given what what Dr. Sarvananda said, if there are so many armed LTTE people in the international arena, and if this leadership is given an amnesty, what possible hope would there be for a later political solution, given that they have been the obstruction, providing the obstruction for any kind of political solution to be negotiated? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Another set of questions. And before the panelists respond, maybe I could sneak one in for Anna, since you haven't gotten one specifically named. You mentioned the possibility or the need for a commission of inquiry to look into war crimes on both sides. And what do you see as the relationship between this drive for justice, if you will, and prospects for negotiating a ceasefire or peace? But let me ask the other panelists to jump in on some of the questions. Now, you don't look like a shy bunch to me, so please.
Okay, I think there was one question from the floor on the demarches made by ASG Walter Kalin and USG Holmes and the promises given by the government, and what is next. I think this time around, there is a time frame, and this time around also some of the donors very clearly explained their position that assistance will be only given to emergency, for emergency assistance, and perhaps nothing in the way of development assistance if conditions in the camps are not improved. So I'm seeing donors that are starting to put conditions. The UN itself did not meet these conditions yet, and we're still engaged, at least in the case of UNHCR, with the government on a daily basis on improving the conditions for IDBs. For us also, we cannot be conditional, because our condition would be to stop assistance to IDBs, for example. We are not a bilateral donor. We cannot. It's not a political negotiation. It's a humanitarian negotiation. It's a humanitarian diplomacy. But we advocate with the government on many of the issues that I have we have received, and many of the donors and the bilaterals have leverage with the government of Sri Lanka.
Mike, would you like to respond?
There was a question here at the end specifically for me, which I'd be happy to respond to, on the sort of end game that we're working toward. I just want to emphasize this is what we would like to see happen, but we don't have any illusions that this is easy to engineer. It's something that we've been working on very hard and quietly behind the scenes, because we see the only potential we see to bring this to an end is to have a package in which we have a pause and the civilians are allowed to leave, and now it's very clear that many, many civilians do want to leave, in spite of the fact the LTT has said earlier they did not want to leave. They do, in fact, want to leave. So we need, what we would like to see is a package in which there's that pause, and then during that pause, not only do the civilians leave, but we also make some arrangements between the government and the LTT that would involve trading off surrender of arms for a limited amnesty. The government of Sri Lanka has previously offered a limited amnesty. This would be for the lower level LTT cadre, not the leadership. And so I think one of the big questions is what to do about the leadership, and that's certainly not easy to answer. But you're quite right. This is a very complex and very difficult sort of thing to orchestrate. There are many problems, and we are running out of time. We really literally have a matter of a couple of days maybe in which we can try to get this finalized. So we are working on it, but I don't want to raise expectations that we're close to a comprehensive agreement. But we want to play any sort of helpful role we can to try to bring it to a peaceful conclusion.
Mr. Krishna?
Yes, I will answer. There was a question about revival of democratic Tamil politics. It is not that the entire Tamil democratic politics is by the so-called ex-militant groups. There are some political parties like TULF, Tamil United Liberation Front, and Tamil Congress, which has been historically a democratic party. They never took up arms. And as regards the so-called ex-militant groups who are either aligned with the government or somewhere in the middle, they have to be disarmed. Before entering, I think government should ensure that they have to disarm before entering any elections or political processes. Like they would expect from the LTTE, there cannot be any double standards on that. So I think Tamil people by and large expect that. You may have known that recently the Tamil United Liberation Front leader, Mr. Ananda Sangri, had visited Manna, Vaunia, and some eastern parts and Jaffna as well, to revive the political offices in those places, anticipating a sort of democratic political process in the future. As regards one of the previous questions, whether both the communities, both the main communities in Sri Lanka could live together is, to me, to be decided by the Sri Lankans of all ethnicities who are presently living in Sri Lanka. It cannot be decided by the diaspora community, whether it's the Tamil diaspora or the Sinhala diaspora. They have come here for good. I'm glad that they are here. I wish them all well. But please don't interfere too much in the domestic politics. That has to be determined by the people, not myself, not by yourself. It has to be determined by the people of Sri Lanka who are domiciled there and who still hold citizenship there. They are the they had the last say on that. Thank you.
Thank you. Anna?
On peace versus justice? Human Rights Watch has a very clear organizational position on that. We do not sacrifice justice for peace. We believe that, and especially I think Sri Lanka is a very good example of that, that you know the lack of accountability historically undermines any peace efforts long term. So I do think that as much as accountability is always a very big issue for Human Rights Watch, and I do believe that Commission of Inquiry may be fully justified, I really, you know, through the whole day today, we actually had these debates, and I don't want to move there yet, because for now, I do think that, you know, I mean, that's what we do in many consults. We come there afterwards, and we, you know, count the dead and look for who is responsible. We're not there yet, so I really would like to focus for now on what can be done to actually save the people who are trapped there. But yes, I do think that the message has to be absolutely clear to both sides of the conflict that what's happening there is not just a humanitarian disaster, and yes, civilians do die in wars, but the way they're dying right now may definitely points out to violations of humanitarian law and may well point out to war crimes being committed, and for that there needs to be accountability.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you all for coming out on a rainy afternoon and to our panelists. I think that, you know, one of the reasons we wanted to schedule this session was just feeling that there needs to be much more public attention as to what is actually going on in Sri Lanka. And if anything, the panelists have certainly underscored the need to keep attention focused on very delicate and challenging operations. Thank you all very much. Thank you.